you need to just go ahead and start with that.
My only problem I'm going to have is with the tape, because what do I do if I don't fill up an hour?
Well, you don't have to fill up an hour.
Okay.
You know, let's just do what we do and then we quit. I don't feel...
No, I mean to say, like, because I know the tape, are these tapes going to be like, you can have like, these are tapes on the afterlife, and, because the last three were completely on the afterlife.
All right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm going to have to ask, if I go back to the Talmud, I don't mind going back to the Talmud, but the thing is, when we go back, it's going to be part of the tape will be in the afterlife, part of the tape being in Talmud. Is that a problem?
No, that, because it, we sell this tapes and sets anyway, and so you already been rolling, and all this is on tape.
Okay.
So they can hear us talk.
Okay.
All right, well, Charlie's got a question for you before we go then.
Okay.
Okay, come on over and ask it. Excuse me? Okay. How you doing?
Good, Charlie. How's it going?
What I wanted to ask, I'm trying to recall a lot of the things that were said the last time you spoke.
Yep.
But I guess the only question, and maybe it's kind of a corny one at that, but I need to ask it because I've thought about it. But it seems that you, our teacher, and David have indicated that we should be more concerned about, you know, this life,
right,
and how we make it better, and I don't disagree with that, but we basically don't want to really talk about anything after this life. And I think the question is, and I hope I can put it in a clear enough language that you can understand, but if that be the case, and we don't really want to talk about anything hereafter, then why would we be concerned with worrying about what might happen after death and just kind of take all we can get here? And in line of, I don't mean necessarily being crooked or mean or distasteful along those lines, but you know, if there's nothing, if there's not nothing, but very little to be said about the life hereafter, it seems to me that that it's hard to follow the teaching that we should just do all this thing for others and do the rightful thing that we've been taught through a lot of the teachings, because it doesn't seem like it's going to matter if when we're dead. It's like everybody's on their own, and there's nothing there, there's nothing, no future there to look forward to. I mean, I guess I'm just speaking personally but in the business world, let's speak of business world just a minute, because you know, you're a rabbi and you teach, and David has his job, and a lot of the other people have different jobs, but it seems difficult to have to back off and see people that are basically just out for whatever they can get, benefit themselves in any manner in which they can. And it's like, okay, what are they working toward? They're trying to better themselves here. And it's like I've heard you and others say that when we pray, we should pray not that, you know, that God necessarily hears us, but we're doing it for ourselves. And so a lot of this teaching, and maybe I'm picking it up wrong, seems to be that okay, everything is toward, you know, ourselves. So therefore, if it is for ourselves that we're praying, if it's for ourselves that we do these things to make a better life, sometimes I'm wondering, maybe I need to change some of the things of the way I do it, because if it's for that reason, I guess I got a few things in mind that I could change to make it better for me, and it'd make it harder for other people and worse for other people, because I would be doing it for a selfish motive. But I restrain from that personally because right. I feel for other people. I mm-hmm. feel for them and what they think and what they how they react to situations and you know their betterment of life. So I'm sort of in some cases sacrificing my own well-being
right.
for their well-being.
Right.
And I don't mean this to be steered toward the teaching we've had in the past of the Christianity
right.
type thing, but I do say there is some merit to want to look toward the life hereafter
right.
to make me feel a little bit better right. that when I get before God that I can say, well, you know, I did this because it was the right thing to do, and even though I suffered through it, someone else may have got the benefit, or at least I was fair to my fellow man,
mm-hmm.
to family or mm-hmm. friends or whoever it might encompass.
Yeah.
And yet, if someone, I told my wife the other day, I said, you know, if I were persuaded
mm-hmm.
that this was the only thing,
right.
this was the only life, I'd be dang if I wouldn't change a lot of things.
Right.
And it'd be better for Charlie. And
right.
it would be worse for others.
Right.
But I'm not persuaded of that, by the way. I'm just saying that maybe you're bringing us through a teaching that you've got to teach us certain things before we go to other things. And I understand that to a point because I'm understanding things now you teach that if you'd have dumped the whole load on me to begin with, I couldn't have handled it. I'd have had a lot of emotional problems over that, too. But I do say, I guess, in the bottom line is that I guess I'm saying is there something about this life hereafter, and I'm not talking about exacts, but I do think that we being me in this case, would feel a little bit better if we thought that there was some merit for the hereafter that will advantage us, our soul, or whatever goes back to God in some point in time.
Yes.
And I hope I've vaguely tried to convey what I've really thought or tried to, you know, tried to convey to you is sensible or...
Yes, makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad you raised these questions. Actually, you're raising two questions there, and I'm going to just separate them out and deal with them individually, okay?
Okay, we'll put you on hold and you can begin.
Okay. All right, now you see this area, as I mentioned before, this area... The rabbis recognize it as a dangerous area because people can get the wrong idea over here. Because and then now, let me try to explain it. I think what Charlie McKeon mentioned is an extremely important point. He mentioned two points. Let me take the first one first. His point is the question is: are we saying that there's no afterlife, or that basically there's no reason for us to be concerned or think about the afterlife? Okay. That the afterlife is not a part of our motivation, all right? Is that true? My answer to that question is no, absolutely not. The as a matter of fact, Maimonides states that King David looked forward to the afterlife. The afterlife is the greatest joy. It is the greatest experience that a human being can have. There is no question about that, okay? There's no question about that, but I'm going to explain what. See, it is a subtle point. It is a difficult point. God made this world with His divine wisdom, and it's not easy for man to understand it. So we have to have a little patience and grapple a little bit in order to get these ideas clear. Okay, now let me just give you a verse here. A verse I've been quoting all along in Psalms. I realize I didn't mention to you where it is. All right. In Psalms, Psalms 19 and 20, all right, it says, "Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak arrogant words proudly and contemptuously against the righteous." All right. Now he says in the next verse, "says Oh, how great is thy goodness, which thou hast." Well, they translate "laid up." Actually, it's not "laid up." It's not a good translation. It means "thou hast concealed." For hidden away, so to speak, for those that fear you. All right. So And right before, I'm sorry, let me just pay attention to verse 18. He says, "Let the wicked be ashamed, and let them be silent in Sheol." Okay, there's that word Sheol.
Now, what was the reference you're using, please?
Oh, it's Psalms 31.
Psalm 31. Okay,
Psalm
thank
31,
you.
Psalm 31, 18, 19, 20.
Okay.
Okay. In 18, he mentions the wicked go to Sheol. All right. In 19, he says that let the lips of those who speak against the righteous be silent. And in 20, he says the powerful verse. It says, "How great is the good that you have hidden away for those that fear you." Now, the rabbis just emphasize this verse, and they say, obviously, he is talking about something hidden away for the righteous, okay? It is not something which is obvious, which means that's a clear reference to a good in the hereafter, some good that is hidden away in the future, all right? And as we mentioned, the afterlife, according to the prophets, and the rabbi cites Isaiah 64, I believe 64:3, where the rabbis interpret the verse to mean that only you God, have seen this good. Only you God know what this good is. But the verse in Psalms, the one I mentioned before, that is the classical verse. How great is the good that you have hidden away for your right for those that fear you, the righteous ones. And that's why it says those who speak against the righteous should be silent. Because they maintain that the righteous have nothing, okay? They have a different value system, and they maintain that the righteous don't have anything. They should be silenced, because really there's the greatest good for the righteous, only they don't see it. Now, this great good is in the afterlife. It's not here, okay? I want to make that clear, that in the philosophy of Torah, there is no question that the true good is the good of the afterlife. That is the ultimate good. And Maimonides, but now just bear with me a little bit. We need a little bit of intellectual tolerance here, okay? One part of Maimonides states, in one place, Maimonides states that the good is the afterlife. That is the good. He says, and the righteous spend all their lives because they are looking forward to the afterlife, okay? And Maimonides explains this in Laws of Repentance. You'll find it in chapter 8, for instance. He says, the good that's hidden for the righteous is the afterlife. He says, and this is an eternal life, which is not followed by death, and it's a good which has nothing evil intermixed with it. All right? He says, that's what the Bible means when it says it'll be good for you, and you'll have lengthy days. So the rabbis say, the oral tradition says it means days that are lengthy means days that are limitless. It means days that are truly good, and that's a reference to the a reference to the afterlife. He says the reward of the righteous is that they should reach that good, and the repayment for the wicked is that they don't get that good. That is the repayment. Okay, he says the wicked are simply they simply die, and they're cut off, and they just cease to exist like an animal. He says, this is what the Torah means when it says to be cut off. Cut off means tikkaris nefesh. That soul should be cut off. It means to say that the moment it dies, it ceases to exist. Okay? Now, whereas the righteous continue to exist. And that's the same concept you find throughout Psalms of Sheol, where King David says, God will not allow me to go down into Sheol. Sheol means that death like an animal dies. It means it's just a pit, and that's the end of that person's existence if he goes into Sheol. But King David says, "I do not go into Sheol," and which means to say that God will, because I have knowledge of God, and because I turn to God, that's why I will be saved from Sheol, and I will continue. Which means to say that he will continue in a superior kind of existence. Okay? Of course, he didn't mean to say he's not going to die. He wasn't a fool. He knew he was going to die. But what he meant is that physically he's going to die, but the ultimate good he will have. And so on the one hand, Maimonides expands on this, and he states that the wise people know that the physical pleasures are really not truly pleasures, that there is a far greater good, okay? And he says, he states, for instance, he says, how much King David, King David said he looked forward to the afterlife because he says that he's looking for the good in the land of the living. The land of the living means a land where there is no death, which is a reference to to the afterlife. So he says the he says that the whole objective, on the contrary, the whole objective of this life and the righteous people look forward to the afterlife. Okay, and then on the other hand, however, on the other hand, now listen carefully. On the other hand, in the very same area of repentance, but in the tenth chapter, the last chapter, he says a person should not say, "I am doing the commandments and keeping the Torah in order that I will receive the afterlife." This is a very low level of existence, he says. He puts that down. He says anyone that does that is like a fool, because they have no concept of what Torah is all about. Now, so we have here a contradiction, or a seeming contradiction, because on the one hand, he says, the whole blessing of our existence is for the afterlife, as Charlie mentioned, that really is our primary motive. On the other hand, he says, anyone that says, I'm going to keep the laws, God's laws, I'm going to live according to God's way, why? Because I want to receive the reward in the afterlife. He says this person is a fool. He is not living on any kind of a level that the Torah recognizes as being of true value. And he says we only permit such people to live that way with the hope that we will educate them further and they will get out of this kind of infantile existence. So it would seem to be a contradiction, because on the one hand he says the greatest scholars, the greatest people look forward to the afterlife. On the other hand, he says you're not supposed to do the commandments in order to receive the afterlife. All right? An open contradiction within a very few lines of Maimonides. All right? Let me explain to you the answer to this dilemma. Okay? And it's extremely important, and it's based on what we've been doing the past three sessions. All right? Now, you have to listen carefully. This is the difference. You see, the good, as I mentioned, the good in Torah, the good really is, the essential good is the study of Torah, study of knowledge, understanding God's truth, okay? That is the essence. As it says in the Shema, you know, the Shema is a very singular chapter of the Torah, because that chapter has been taken, put into the Tefillin, put into the Mezuzah. So you see, it contains the most important precepts of the Torah. And right in there it says, what does it say right in there? I mean, you don't even have to go to the oral traditions, right in the written tradition. It states, and these words shall be on your heart, okay? And you shall teach them to your children. And that word, by the way, shinantam, it means, that word comes from shinun, means sharpness. So like when you sharpen a sword, it's used shinun, which means you should teach it to them sharply, with depth, with understanding. Alright? And, you shall speak in them when? When you're sitting in your house, right? When you're going on the road, when you're going to sleep, when you're waking up. What does all that mean? And then it says you should write them on the posts, okay? Now, what does it mean? What does this mean? I mean, just any person just reads without any. We know what the oral tradition says it means, but I'm just telling you, if you just look at these verses with a clear mind, obviously, what is the Torah saying? The Torah saying you should have some kind of preoccupation, something you do when you're sitting in your house, when you're on the road, when you're going to sleep, when you're getting up. This implies clearly a constant preoccupation. What is the preoccupation with? What is it with? With these words that I am commanding you. That's what the verse says. And these words that I am commanding should be on your heart. What does it mean on your heart? It means you should have an emotional tie to these things. This is what you should be interested in. Not watching television. You should be interested in Torah. Constantly. Pursuing it. When you're on the road. You're on the road. So what are you doing on the road? You're discussing some idea of Torah. Okay? I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik said that during the liberation there was an English officer, and in the camps he noticed two men that had gone through the concentration camps. They were rather young men, and they were yeshiva bachers. They studied yeshiva. And he walked by, and he noticed every time he would be near them, he says they would be discussing an argument between these different arguments. He couldn't. He asked them, "What is this?" He says, "Well, we're discussing something from the Talmud." You know, he was amazed, like that these people are here. They're waiting for the liberation, and the most important thing on their mind is an argument in the Talmud between two scholars and trying to understand what the argument is, trying to understand this piece of Torah. Okay, this is what the Torah is talking about. This is the kind of level that the Torah wants man to reach. And that's why, what do the rabbis say? The rabbis say, a ben Noach that is involved in Torah, okay, is as great as the high priest. What does that mean? That means to say, what does it mean? It means a person, a ben Noach, a man that is involved, that lives Torah, that is drawn to the ideas of Torah, loves God's ideas. He tries to understand it. He tries to learn, pursue knowledge. It's constantly a part of his life. It's a preoccupation. He's going to sleep. He's getting up. He's walking. He's going. He's thinking in the back of his mind, he's thinking about the most important involvement that a person can have in the world, and that is studying God's Torah. That's the most important thing that a person can do. That's his preoccupation, okay? That is the level that the Torah strives to bring man to. That's what the whole Torah is about, to bring man to that level of appreciation, okay? Where his main concern should be constantly the knowledge and the knowledge of Torah, the love of Torah, and the enjoyment of understanding Torah. That is man at his height. Okay, that's man at his highest. All right. Now, let's get back to this question that we were discussing before. All right. What Maimonides is saying is very simple. On the one hand, if a person says that I am going to do whatever the Torah says, I'm going to adopt the Torah's philosophy. I want to be in good with God. Okay, so therefore, I'll study Torah when I get up in the morning, when I go to sleep, when I'm on the road. Okay, and I'll do all the commandments that I can. If I'm a Ben Noach, I'll make sure I do my seven, and even beyond that, all the commandments have to do with perfection, like the evil tongue and various not to be envious, and all those laws that have to do with perfection, okay, I will do those too. But the reason why I'm doing it is because I want to get paid back reward in the next world, that God should repay me, okay? So I'm struggling with all this in order to get the big payoff. Okay, Charlie mentioned the businessman. That would be like a businessman's mentality, all right? And I tell you this, I'm going into business. Why am I doing this? I'm doing this because I want to earn a living. I want to earn money, okay? I want to build an empire, whatever it might be, whatever level is, various levels. But the point is, it's a trade-off. A businessman will not go into business if he knew he's never going to make a dime the rest of his life. What is he going to go into business for? It would be silly, all right? So you go into business, you work in order to get a payoff, okay? That is the average person's life, okay? Most of the things he does because he's looking for something else in return. Now, this is what Maimonides means. That person, if he applies that business kind of mentality over here, he is a fool because this doesn't belong over here. Because he's saying to God, I'm doing all your commandments, I'm being a good boy, so that you repay me when I get to the next world. So what does that mean to say? That means to say, God didn't give me something that's really good. He gave me some painful kind of thing to do. Why? I don't know. That's his idea. He wants me to do this. I don't know why. Does he need me to do this? Then many people are religious with the idea that they're doing God a favor. They're helping God. God needs me to do this. Now that, in our system, in the system of Torah, that's idolatry. Because you're saying that God needs your help. God is in his most ridiculous and silly notion to say that the creator of the universe creates a little human being that is in order to help him. It's nonsensical to begin with, and it's a denial of our idea of God, that God doesn't lack and has no diminution, has no lack in any manner, shape, or form. He doesn't need anything. He doesn't need us, okay? We are a part of his creation, but he doesn't need us to do him any favors. That's a silly notion, and it's a notion which is idolatrous. So then people get caught up into that. But most people do operate on that infantile level. It's like a teacher, you know? We'll be good in school, and then we get a good grade, all right? So this is what Maimonides is talking against, he says. Anyone that does that, that's the trade-off concept, the exchange. I'm doing this for an exchange, you see. That concept is an infantile notion. Not only is it infantile, but you have to think about it a little more, and you'll see it's degrading. It's degrading. You're actually degrading God when you do that. Why? Because you're saying to God, you gave me something to do, which isn't really good, and I'm just doing it for you, now you're going to give me something better. So the real good is not what he, not the Torah that he gave you, that's not good. That's just something that's hard and difficult, and it's not really good. I'm just doing it to get paid back later, which means there's a greater thing than Torah itself. Okay? So then God gave you something which is not good, and it's some kind of a game he plays. All right? You do this hard, painful thing, and then I'll give you something good. Like, this is another lollipop, theory. And that kind of a theory in Torah, in Judaism, is infantile, silly, and it's even, as I said, it even borders on blasphemy. Because in the unconscious mind, the person thinks he's doing God a favor in some shape, manner, form, in the back of his mind, which is blasphemous. Okay? So that's what Maimonides rails against. He says anyone that believes that is really degrading the Torah, okay, and he's operating on a childish level, and we permit him or her to do so until we can raise them to a higher level. You know, you have to do it every person. But that level itself, if a person would only remain on that level all their lives would be worthless, basically. Okay? Because they're misconstruing the whole gift of Torah. They're saying God's great gift that he gave us this knowledge, this wonderful gift, he's saying that's not really good. Just do that so I'll give you something better. Okay? That explains that second area of my mind is where he says a person should not. See, that's what they're asking. A person should not be like the servant that's serving the master in order to receive reward. In other words, well, why does the servant serve the master? He doesn't. He wouldn't serve the master if he were wealthy himself. Would he be enslaving himself and serve the master? No. He's looking for he wants the exchange. Okay. He wants to gain something. That is improper. Okay. But now let's look at it another way. And now we're going to get to the other side with the afterlife. And this is, it's important, it's very important that Charlie raises this question. The true way to look at it is on the contrary. That this Torah which God gave us, and this way of life that he expounds in his Torah, this is the greatest gift. Why? Because this is the greatest life. A person that keeps Torah, as a matter of fact, there is no such thing as self-sacrifice in the idea of Torah, in a strict sense. There's no such thing as self-sacrifice for a simple reason. Because whatever you're doing, if it's good, then it's good for you. If God gave it to you in the Torah, that means that this, in fact, is the good. Now, what does the good mean? It's not a good for, who is it good for? It's good for me, good for human beings. So that means that by keeping the Torah, I'm doing something good for myself. Now I'm in line with my true nature. This is what I was meant is to be in the creation. This is now I'm actually fulfilling my potential. If that's the case, so then who is better off? Am I better off by doing it? Or is the other person who's involved in stealing, involved in all the physical desires, hedonistic pleasures, is that person the person that has the good life? Or do I have the good life by keeping Torah? What's the answer? The answer is straightforward. The hedonist and the person that is living the other life that seems pleasurable and lustful is really in a state of pain. Because he wasn't created for that. That is not good for him. And if you really looked into his life, you'd see he has a miserable existence. Yeah, there may be moments of pleasure, but essentially his existence is misery. Whereas the person who lives according to the ideas of Torah, that person has a truly happy, satisfying existence. Okay? So, you're not doing God a favor by keeping the Torah. He did you the favor by giving you the Torah. You see? People have it wrong. Because if you listen to the Torah, you're doing the best favor for...
All right, go.
All right. Okay. So, again, when you keep the Torah... Now, Charlie's question is like this. When you help another person, all right? When you help another person, you're doing a good deed. But that good deed, that helping of another person, the greatest thing is for you yourself. You know why? And because for a moment, self-indulgence, which doesn't lead a person to happiness, only leads a person to misery, all right? That's the fooler. People think that they're indulging themselves. They're not indulging. They're indulging in themselves, and that's why they're miserable. The Torah is a different concept. The Torah says, if you could raise yourself for a moment out of those emotions, and you can perceive life on a higher level, and you can perceive the wisdom of God and His wisdom in creating man, and you look at another human being as a creature that was created by God, and you recognize the value of a human being, and then you recognize that he has a place in the universe just like you do, and then you help that being, then you're helping yourself, because you've raised yourself to a higher level, a higher form of existence, and your satisfactions of our greater nature. So the one you've helped is really yourself, okay? But we say that the ultimate good is the study and the knowledge of Torah. And I explained that one time, that you cannot just say that helping another person is the good. Christianity tries to say that, but it doesn't work logically. Because if I'm helping him, so then what's his good? His good is to help somebody else, and helping, and it goes on infinitum, it's senseless. The helping another person is not the good. It is a part of the picture of the good. The ultimate picture of the good is the essence of the good is the study of Torah. That is the good. All right. But in order to study Torah, in order to recognize that good, part of recognizing that good involves the love of God. When a person studies Torah, so then he becomes involved in the love of the Creator. And when he has a love for the Creator, he has to love God's creation. And he loves God's creation, he becomes a benefactor. All right. That's in that sense we say he imitates God, just like God benefits. So man also, when he reaches a truly high level, so then he enjoys being a benefactor. Okay, that's a part of the picture. But the essence of the picture is the Shema, the love of God, which involves the constant preoccupation in Torah. That's what it says in the Shema, as I mentioned before. First it says you should love the Lord your God, and then it tells you exactly how to do it. These words should be on your heart when you get up, when you go to sleep, constantly in the back of your mind. You're thinking about about being involved in Torah. By the way, there is a halachic, and I always like to bring halachic sources. You know, people read a lot of Midrash, but they don't know what they're reading, because the Midrash is a parable, and you have to know how to interpret it. But the halacha is clear and straightforward. There's no question about what it means. Okay? And the halacha states, you know, there's a blessing that you make in the morning before you study Torah. Now, that blessing goes for the entire day, and, you know, in general, there cannot be, between a blessing and an activity, there cannot be any space. In other words, if I make a blessing on a fruit, so I can't put the fruit down and come back a half hour later and eat the fruit. Because there must be a close proximity of time between the blessing and between the object. Whether it's a mitzvah, or let's say I make a blessing on the talit, on my, you know, the prayer shawl. So I can't make a blessing on the prayer shawl, go into the other room, read a book, and come back and put on the prayer shawl. That would be worthless. I must put it on right away. Now, the question is raised is, how come I make a blessing on studying Torah in the morning, and in the afternoon, if I want to say I come back from work 5 o'clock and I want to study Torah, I don't make another blessing. I rely on the blessing in the morning. But there was this whole span of time in between where I did all these other things. So how could that be? So the answer is, because a really righteous person, when he goes to work, he's preoccupied really with Torah. He thinks, see, the mitzvah of Torah is not an activity. It's more than an activity. It's a preoccupation. It's being involved. That's the commandment. To be involved in it. This should be on your heart. It means important to you. I can't wait to get back to Torah. So really, when a person is working, a person who loves Torah, even when he's working, in the back of his mind, he's waiting, hey, when am I going to finish so I can sit down and study some Torah, you see? So there never is a space, because he's always preoccupied in the back of his mind with Torah. And that's why the blessing is really on this whole state of mind in relationship to Torah. And that state of mind should be with a person no matter what he's doing. That's what the Bible says. When you're walking, when you're going, when you're sitting in the house, getting up, going to sleep, it should always be in the back of your mind. This should be what you're really interested in. Okay, this should be your primary interest. Enjoying the beauty of God's knowledge, studying Torah. That is where it's at. Now, let's go back to the world to come, okay? Now, the way we understand the world, the way Torah understands it, and I told you that it's a very difficult idea, and that's why the Torah does not state it openly, because it would be completely misconstrued. All right? But the idea is that in the afterlife, once we lose the physical body that we have, then the soul is freed from the body. It does not have the limitations of the body anymore. And it exists in a totally free way, which means that the soul can function after death to the greatest, uninhibited by the body, and it functions to the greatest degree. Okay? Now, a person that enjoys Torah in this world, could you imagine how much they will enjoy it in the next world? Infinitely more, because they won't have the limitations of the physical that we have here. All right? So any person that has an enjoyment always looks forward to a time when this enjoyment can be augmented, enhanced. All right? So, therefore, that's what Maimonides means when he says that the great scholars look forward to the world to come. What this means is they don't look forward to the world to come as an exchange. God gave me the Torah. I was a good boy. Now give me something better. No, that would be derogatory. That would be degrading. But the way they look forward is that they say, God gave us such a wonderful life here with the Torah. Now we're going to be able to be involved in a limitless way with the Torah. This is something to look forward to. This is the great reward. This is an enjoyment which is beyond any enjoyment that a person can perceive of in this world, because all our physical pleasures are limited, extremely limited. And every pleasure, by the way, whether you're aware of it or not, but every passionate pleasure really has to carry with it pain. That's a necessity. People many times don't realize what they're doing. They think they're having pleasure, but really, if they thought about it, they see they're having pain. For instance, if a person eats. Now, when a person's hungry, he enjoys food. But if he keeps on eating beyond as soon as the hunger stops, then the pleasure stops. And if he goes beyond that, he's just going to be in pain. So the pleasure of the eating is only there as long as you have the pain of the hunger. If you did not have pain, the true enjoyment of food is only if a person really is hungry. So he must have the desire for food in order to have the food. Now, a desire is always a pain. If a person is in a state of desire, he's in a state of pain. And that is the same thing is true with the enjoyment of love. The person, the love, you can only enjoy love if you have a tremendous desire involved. Now, as long as you have desire is a state of pain. So the satisfaction is only there as long as you have the desire. And as soon as you satisfy the desire, that's it. There's no more. The desire is gone. The satisfaction is gone. So all our pleasures in this existence are always tied to pain. Without pain, there is no pleasure. Pain and pleasure are very closely related. Socrates noticed this thousands of years ago, and psychoanalysts have taken up on this in a different approach, and they've shown that's true also. But it's true psychologically and it's true philosophically. So what Maimonides is explaining is that the physical pleasures are not really what people think they are. They always involve pain. But there is one pleasure that we can have in this existence, which is the purest, and that is the appreciation of the beauty of Torah. That's something we can have here. And anyone that has it here thanks God and is fortunate for having that ability, and he looks forward with even greater joy to the afterlife, where he can engage in knowledge of God in a limitless way. All right? You see, everything that we have in this world, we're very limited by the physical. For instance, our knowledge comes through our senses. Without the senses, without people, as you know, are unfortunate, who are missing the senses, have difficulty not only in a physical way, but in an intellectual way as well, because they're limited. So in this existence, the soul is limited by the physical. It's tied to the physical in a strange way that God in his infinite wisdom saw fit to do. Okay? We still don't understand fully how it works, but we know one thing, that there is this connection between the part of us that perceives the eternal and the part of us that's limited by the physical. So that's why Maimonides is not in contradiction, you see. When he says that the righteous people and the great people look forward to the world to come, afterlife is really everything, because that's really, and if you, anyone that read through any of the Talmud knows that the Talmud says the afterlife, it says today, it's like a prepper, and we're in a preparatory phase, okay? And the ultimate good is really the afterlife. That's because that we only have a part of it over here, and over there it expands into something completely that would seem to us completely unreal. In other words, it's augmented and enhanced in ways that we don't even comprehend. The kind of experience that we have, the kind of intellectual experience that we have after death in the afterlife, is completely different, and it's, the enjoyment is greater, and it's a completely different kind of thing, but it's an expansion of the good, okay? But even if a person, but the Torah doesn't want to sell an afterlife, because then people would get the wrong idea. They'd say, I'm going to do God's commandments, so I get paid in the afterlife, which means I'm doing something painful to get paid for something that's really good. So there's something better than Torah. That is a fool, and that is why the Torah always says, do the Torah because it is good for you here. A person should do that which is good for him right now. The most an intelligent person is concerned first of all with the most immediate. That should be a person's first concern. Any person that's intelligent, the first is, well, let's see what's happening today and tomorrow. I mean, that's the most important thing. So there the Torah steps right in and tells us, this is the good. If you follow the way of Torah, you can have the best possible life right here. This is the way to live. This is the way to enjoy life. Want to have a great life? Keep the Torah. The Torah will give you the most enjoyable life possible. But when a person realizes what that good is, and that good stems from God's knowledge, then a person comes to the realization that and a desire to expand this experience, that experience can only be expanded upon in the afterlife. And that's where it finds its full existence. Its potential is fully realized in the afterlife. So now the question is, so why do I do it? Do I do it for here or for there? What's the answer? The answer is for both, because it is the best way to live here, number one, and two, it's something which puts us on the route where in the afterlife we'll be able to experience far greater experience than we have over here. Okay? That is the answer. And that's why the rabbis say that it says, Ashrecha v'tovlach. And Ashrecha means that it is, Ashrecha means you are very fortunate, and it is good for you. This is, so the rabbis explain the expression, what the expression means, the expression found in the prophets. It means you are fortunate in this world, and it's good for you in the next world. Which means both, okay? So that is the answer to the question. But the Torah only mentions the here. It does not mention the hereafter, because people never get that idea straight. In order for the Torah to mention the hereafter, the Torah has to write a whole philosophy of what it means by hereafter. That's not the style of the Torah. The written law does not expand on philosophical principles. The written law has allusions to philosophical principles, but the oral law is where the real philosophy and the halacha and the science of Torah takes place, in the oral, not in the written. The written is written on in a way that a simple person can read it and get the basic idea, enough to know that you have to pursue this a little further. Okay, but the Torah is not a book for abstract philosophy. This requires a lot of work. So that's why the Torah just gives the immediate. Says, do it right now. This is good for you right here. And the Torah also states that the people of Israel, if they keep the law, then the divine providence will play a role and will give them all the things that they need in order to exist, the good. And that's what I'm going to discuss at this point, okay? If there's any question, if you, David, I think you wanted to jump in over here, or somebody else?
Well, I've been waiting for you to stop.
Okay, there I go.
All right. I've got two things that a question.
Wait, did I answer Charlie's question? Because that's important. I'm trying to
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Here, he said, did a good job. I would summarize your statement this way. The reason the Torah does not spend a lot of time dealing with the afterlife is because the instinctual man, the appeal to him is to the afterlife.
Exactly.
All right, so therefore the Torah teaches us how to mm-hmm. conquer the instinctual man in this life.
Beautiful. I couldn't have put it better myself. So, and again, with the Egypt, you have to realize where people came from Egypt. What was Egypt? Egypt was doing everything over here in order for what? In order to have the real instinctual over there. They killed the slaves and they took their things with them in the tombs. That was the instinctual life par excellence, and they perceived the afterlife as, hey, now we're really going to have the instinctual enjoyment. The Torah avoided that. It took them out of Egypt and away from that whole kind of philosophy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm about. And so the Torah deals with to subjugate the instinctual man in this world so that the spiritual man can sail in the world to come.
Exactly.
Okay. This is two questions, but it's two aspects of the same question. Number one, if the afterlife is concerning the soul only, then how does God... Wait a minute, I got to put my glasses on because I can't read it. All right, if the afterlife is concerning with the soul only, then how does God destroy that which he created, in other words, the evil? That's Isaiah 45:7. Second aspect of the same question, do you carry the Torah knowledge gained in this world to the world to come?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So those are two aspects of the same question.
Do you carry the Torah knowledge gained in this world, in the world to come, is question one. And the second question was, God destroying evil, which the Isaiah 45.
That's correct. Does God destroy, if the afterlife is concerning the soul only, then does God destroy the evil which he created?
Okay. All right, now, let me take the second question first. Is the Torah, do you take the Torah with you? This I could tell you, from the rabbis and the scholars of the Talmud, they always speak about the fact that a person is fortunate who comes into the next world with his Torah. But they also mention that in the afterlife, a person has a greater opportunity, and if a person had a desire to study Torah and he was unable to study in this world, that this alone God accommodates him and permits him and gives him the opportunity to study over there too. Okay, so it's not just again. I mean, you know, we always look for these simple solutions. It is not that simple, and we're talking about God and how God works. So, you know, what does the prophet say? Our thoughts are not his thoughts. So we have to know that we're just like, in a general way, we understand it, but we don't know all the particulars. But this much we say. That a person who has knowledge here of Torah, he takes that knowledge with him, and the knowledge over there is increased, and he sees it in a deeper, far deeper way, and it is tied into a knowledge of the Creator himself. Okay? And also, a person that didn't have the opportunity to study Torah, but had a desire to study Torah, will have that desire fulfilled in the next world. God gives him the opportunity to study Torah there. Now, of course, you ask me who's better and who's this. I'm not going to get into that. Okay? Those kind of questions God will answer. But those are like curiosity questions. And as I said before, scholars try to stick to what they know. We don't know. We're only human beings. And we're fortunate that God gave us the amount of insight into these things that he did. And beyond that, you know, we have curiosity. It's very nice. But it's something that has to be, has to be controlled sometimes. Now, the other question, the question was about God creating evil. I want to set that one straight. That, I think, is a mistake that people make. And I think especially Christianity has made that mistake. God does not create evil. That is an impossibility. God does not create, again, God does not create evil. Now, the question you asked me is the verse in 45, Isaiah 45, where it says openly, all right, it says he creates the light, and he forms the light and creates darkness. All right, he does peace and creates evil. All right, he says, I, God, do all these things. All right, now the problem is, of course, when a person takes a verse out of context, and the Torah is a very deep thing. And people have a lot of crazy notions. And what happens is the person has a notion and he sees a verse and he thinks, that verse is saying exactly what I'm thinking. That must be it. You see? Not so quickly. You have to analyze the words of the prophets. The prophets were men of great, great genius. And when they write something, it's a deep idea. You can't just take it as it appears on the surface, even though it may be in line with a person's simplistic kind of notions. You see, those simplistic notions are usually 99% of the time, they're completely off. All right? Now, if you take a look at Isaiah 45, you'll see, read the few verses before, all right, and you'll see what Isaiah is trying to say. He says, and take verse 5, for instance, I am God, and there is none other besides me. Besides me, there is no God. Okay? Then, verse 6. In order they shall know that from the rising of the sun, that there is Ephes. There is nothing, zero, besides me. I am God, and there is no other. All right, that's verse 6. Now, verse 7. He forms the light and creates darkness. He does peace and creates evil. I, God, do all these things. You understand what the prophet is trying to tell people? You see, the prophet is speaking out against the pagan belief. The pagan belief is that there are two forces in the universe, a good force and a bad force. Okay? Dualism, it was called. All right? Now, this idea that there are bad forces is, Isaiah is saying, is a denial of God. Because there is nothing, and that's why he reiterates in these previous verses, there is nothing besides God. Okay? That's what he's saying. See, God says, there is nothing besides me. Okay? What Isaiah is trying to show people is that evil, people think that evil is something other. There are two forces, there's a good force and an evil force. So Isaiah says, you're making a mistake. Everything comes from God. Now, what does that mean? What it means is like this. See, man has free will. In order for man to have free will, he has to be able to choose a life that is good, and if he distorts his life, it's evil. Who creates evil if man has free will? Who creates evil? Man or God? The answer, obviously, is man. But now, if I ask you, does that mean that evil is a force in the universe, another force, like a devil or something else? No. It was made. Did God create it? In a sense, yes. Because there's only one creator, and all creation came from God. So when God created man, and man has free will, so in one sense, I could say that, well, it all came from God. But God never created evil. God created man with free choice. Man, since he has free choice, and God's wisdom is that man should exist with this free choice, so man has the potential for evil. But when man does evil, it's not an outside force, another force besides God that he's involving himself with. That's what Isaiah is trying to tell the people. Because the ancients and the primitive people, and there's a carryover into the New Testament as well, with the devil as an alien force, an evil, a Satan, an evil. Okay? That is a denial of God, because the moment you say there's another force besides God, that is already a denial of God. And that is what Isaiah is trying to tell people. He's saying there is nothing besides me, and if there's evil in the world, it's not from another source. I am the ultimate source of everything. You see, I, God, do all this, which means everything that exists only exists because of me. But that doesn't mean that God directly creates evil. That does not mean that. Heaven forbid. God doesn't create it. But God's wisdom is that man should have free choice. If man has free choice, then he could do the wrong choice, and when he does the wrong choice, he creates evil. But is that another force? No, that all stems from God. There is nothing besides God. There is no dualism. There is no other force. That's what Isaiah is trying to point out. Okay? Now, the idea of evil being abolished in the world to come, okay, which is or in the afterlife, is very simple, because the concept of evil in the Torah is, as the rabbis say, there are three terms. The one term is called the angel of death, all right. The other term is called the evil inclination, and the other term is called Satan. Okay? Now, in several places that these three are one and the same thing. Satan, the evil inclination, and the angel of death are all the same. All right? Now, what does it mean? It means to say that all these things stem from the physical aspect of man. All right? The evil inclination is the instinctual, as David mentioned. That's the evil inclination. Now, the angel of death is the fact that since man is a physical, biological object, so he can't exist forever. He has to die. That's the angel of death. That's why it's also part of the fact, the element of the physical. And Satan, what is meant by Satan, is external circumstances that are untoward, that man, see, the word Satan in Hebrew always means an antagonist. For instance, it says by King Solomon that God set up a Satan for him. What was a Satan? Another king that was always bothering him. That's what the word says. It's not a mystical meaning. I mean, Christians came along and gave it a mystical meaning. It's not a mystical meaning. It means something which is a disturbance, an outside nuisance. Okay? Now, sometimes the nuisance is an outside thing that he can't control, but sometimes that outside thing that he can't control is inside him. When a person has an emotion that he cannot control, it's referred to as a Satan. Why? Because it means it's like a nuisance, but the nuisance is a part of him. He has an unruly kind of emotion. Something is, in common expression, something's bugging him. You see, he doesn't know what it is. It's bothering him. That's what is meant by Satan.
Reverend, so, you got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you. So what is meant by the fact that the evil will cease does not exist in the afterlife, it means that in the afterlife, once the soul exists in its pure state, then the physical part is not related to him anymore, and that's why there is a cessation of the evil. Okay? But this is not, you understand what I'm saying? In other words, and the same thing when we say that in the world to come, which is on this earth, so there again we say that man, the Bible says in Deuteronomy, that God will circumcise your heart. What is the circumcision of the heart? It means that the heart will be more sensitive to the wisdom of the person, the knowledge of Torah that they have, and there won't be that struggle. We experience a struggle. Even though we recognize the truth of Torah, we still have to struggle to get ourselves to learn. That struggle will be lightened, and the heart, the emotions, will naturally follow what the person's mind tells him is the good through his knowledge of Torah. So there again, we say that means that evil, then the person, when a person knows what the good is, a person would never choose evil if they really understand the good and if their emotions can go along with the good. So that's what is meant, that in the world to come, which is on this planet, the evil will cease to exist. It means man will have knowledge, and his emotions will follow that knowledge. Okay, we'll stop here.